Welcome to the Caving Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pelser of the Central Indiana Grotto. If you're here because you're already a caver, welcome or welcome back. If you've never gone cave exploring before, that's probably good because if you're going to do it, you need to do it right and with the right people. I'm happy to tell you that those people shouldn't be too hard to find. All you need to do is contact your local grotto. That's a chapter of the National Speleological Society, and you can find the one closest to you at their website, caves.org. Easy to remember, caves.org. Find out who the officers are, when and where they meet, and get in touch with them. Caving can be dangerous if you don't know what you're doing, but very safe if you do. Always wear a helmet and proper safety equipment. Carry no less than 3 sources of light. Never go alone. Those are the guidelines. There are others, but those are the big ones. Beth Courtwright is my guest this month. I'm so glad to have her. You're about to hear a great talk. She's an incredible caver who's done so much. More on Beth in a minute. I've been contacted by a listener who's also a financial supporter of the podcast. Believe it or not, I do have a few bills associated with the podcast, and they want me to highlight some of the great work being done by cave and karst conservancies across the country. So I thought I'd share some good news from the SCCI. If you're not familiar, you should be. That's the Southeastern Cave Conservancy, and they own and manage thousands of acres of land containing over 170 caves across 6 states, Tennessee, Alabama, Georgia, Florida, West Virginia, Kentucky. Visitation of the preserves requires permits, which usually only take a few days to process. And some of the preserves offer same-day permits that are issued instantly and automatically as soon as the releases are signed and submitted. I saw Ray Knott, the executive director, give a talk on SCCI at Indiana Cave Capers last year. I couldn't believe how much SCCI gets it in that regard. It all equals a really great caving-friendly organization that owns some amazing classic caves. And their most recent acquisition is the Charles B. Hansen Preserve at Johnson's Crook. 2,300 acres of karst in northwest Georgia with more than 30 known caves, with the stars of the show, of course, being Johnson's Crook Cave and also Lost Canyon Cave and Gypsy Cave. This is big news for the SCCI, and their efforts to work this out should really be commended. But with this huge acquisition comes huge responsibility. Of course, the SCCI encourages visitation, responsible visitation, and that means some low-impact development, designating parking areas, constructing trails, basic recreational structures, all of which costs money, not to mention stewardship of the land as well, which applies to all SCCI preserves. So I guess this is my pitch to encourage you to become a member of SCCI. It's $35 a year. And aside from the standard membership card, stickers, newsletter, members get invitations to members-only events and discounts on tickets to their annual Bats, Beer, and Bluegrass event, which sounds really fun. When Ray came and talked at Indiana Cave Capers, he talked a lot about that, and I want to go. Also, $10 off orders off $100 or more through Intermountain Outfitters. If you're already an SCCI member, or maybe you can give a little more when you become a member, it all helps. Dig deep and give to SCCI if you can, and definitely visit some of their preserves. Just go to saveyourcaves.org, saveyourcaves.org, or SCCI.org. Okay, so Beth Courtwright. This is another caver Ellen Whittle put me in touch with. Thanks again, Ellen. I won't be the last either, but Beth just did another NSS webinar on the Grand Canyon's Double Bopper Cave, hitting the 40-mile mark. We actually talked about that, but we talked before she did that webinar in mid-March. If you get a chance, though, you should check that out. It should still be on the first page of the webinar section of the NSS website. What a great conversation. She talks about her early days project caving in southern Kentucky, caving for archaeological sites down in Mexico. Really, really cool stuff at caving the Grand Canyon. And, of course, her work in Lecce Guia. Always a necessary topic anytime I get to talk to a Lecce caver. It was a pleasure to talk to Beth, and I hope you enjoy it, too. This is me and New Mexico caver Beth Courtwright. You got your start in caving in Kentucky, I guess?
Yeah. So I was born and raised in Cincinnati. And while I was in school there, I asked a guy that I knew from, from the Herpetological Society, how I would get involved in something like caving, because I knew that that was something that he did. And he said, what are you doing next weekend? And you know, the rest they say is history. I went with them that next weekend and almost every other weekend for the next couple of years. The group that I got involved with was also involved in a project helping some archaeologists to map caves in the Yucatan. And these were caves that were they were situated underneath the ruins or the sites that the archaeologists were working in, and they wanted to do some surveying of the caves and, you know where they were getting their artifacts from inside the caves, you know, precisely. So, you know, we were like, well, we can do that. We can, you know, map the cave from the top to the bottom, and then help you like put it essentially a survey point on these artifacts that they were going to excavate. And geez, I did that for another 5 years, five summers down there.
Wow.
It was a great gig. It was, you know, funded by the archaeologist, and very hot caves, little bat ridden caves.
I would imagine at that latitude, they do get a little warm.
Oh gosh. So warm and so much guano. And, and I went to school for entomology. So, you know, so many cool insects, and I loved that part. And yeah, really got involved down there. And really all I ever did was project caving. I never knew what recreational caving was because of this group that I was involved in was very focused on surveying caves in this one area, you know, almost to the Tennessee border in southern Kentucky. And yeah, that's where I learned almost everything I know. And then I got invited in 2011, I got invited to a week-long expedition in Lechuguilla with Hazel Barton, and kind of never looked back. I mean, I still love Kentucky and Kentucky caves. I just, within the next year of that, or year after that, I moved out here, and I've been in New Mexico ever since.
New Mexico. Okay. So let's go back home. Let's go back to Kentucky.
Okay.
But what were the caves down there? If you're comfortable sharing names or something like that, what were some of the caves that you kind of first cut your teeth in? And was this was mostly survey work, but there was some scientific work that you did?
Right. So at the time, Hazel was at NKU, Northern Kentucky University, working, and, you know, so a lot of her field work, and I think it still is, a lot of her field work is down in Southern Kentucky. And there's an area down there that a certain group of cavers has been working very, very hard for the past 20 plus years to bring the landowner relations to a place where they can essentially work and play in the area and map these caves with the support of the landowners. And Hazel was in that same group, so she ended up doing a lot of microbiology and work in the caves and bringing students there to do work. And let's see, some of the caves, Triple S Cave is down there, and also Grace and Gunner were the caves that I remember most fondly. And they're all limestone stream caves. And I get cold very easily. So I was always either in a wetsuit or in lots and lots of layers, and very different from some of the caving that I do now. That's where we were there. I was in this group that leased a house or rented a house in the valley where we were doing all this cave work. And, you know, it was great to just go, you know, have a place to be or a place to stay every other weekend, you know, every weekend when we would go down there. And usually a handful of us or more were driving down from Cincinnati each weekend or so.
So these landowner issues, and you don't have to name names or caves or anything like that, but that I've heard about this before. And does that kind of seem like a sticking point for that area? It's so rural, and you have these people that have lived there. They're probably their families for generations. And so they see these, you know, essentially outsiders coming in and wanting to traipse over their land. I mean, that had to have been sort of delicate diplomatic work in making that happen.
Of course. I mean, we would talk to the landowners almost every time we went to their caves, and we put a lot of effort into making them happy. I mean, especially with the work that we were doing. So bringing them printed photographs or copies of the map, you know, we definitely made an effort to do that, as well as, you know, I can remember sitting around the table one weekend, and instead of caving one of the days, we put together, you know, holiday baskets, and we were taking those all around to all of the landowners that we were very reliant on their, you know, access to their property to be working in these caves and looking for more caves. And you know, the better the relationship was, the more we would find in that area, undoubtedly, because they would end up, you know, talking to a neighbor and saying, oh, you have a cave on your property. Well, I know these great people. They gave me this awesome map and, you know, they told me what's down there, and heck, I don't want to go down there, but you know, they, yeah, the, here's their contact information, or, you know, they'll tell us about so-and-so, and, you know, we'll go look them up and send them a letter or, you know, pay them a visit someday. And yeah, for sure. That was one of the most important things we saw ourselves doing, was keeping those landowner relations positive and open. And
yeah. I'm always so surprised at how many landowners have never been in the cave, have no interest in going the cave. Did you pretty much only encounter that, or did you have a few people that you talked to either in Kentucky or really anywhere that you've been where they were like, yeah, we've been in there, or yeah, we'd love to go. What do we do?
Yeah. So we actually had a few landowners that were very interested in kind of getting a tour of their own cave, and even some other landowners that were even more involved. I mean, they would, you know, help us with the other relations, or they would, you know, help us make up those holiday cards, or, you know, let us stay at their place, or yeah, sure, you can change in our barn. And you know, they would go caving with us, often. But yeah, the more common, but definitely the most common, type of landowner we would come across is that guy that says, yeah, the only time I ever get near that entrance is when my dog gets stuck in there, or, you know, yeah, we did get a few that, it was kind of odd that they would want a tour of their own property. But
did you ever get anybody who was just sort of in awe at that this was theirs? Like they saw it and they were just like, wow, this is mine. And maybe something clicked in them, something turned on. Or did you ever, on the flip side, have an experience where things turned sour for any reason?
You know, I never had an experience where things turned really sour with a landowner.
Good.
I know a few awkward conversations where, you know, they were worried about somebody getting hurt, or, you know, should I be charging you to do this? Or, you know, is this going to be the next mammoth cave? And is that what you're keeping from us? Or, you know, what are you keeping from us? Those kind of questions. And, you know, it's Southern Kentucky. You have to be open and willing to talk to these people. And sometimes it is a little tough to get them to, you know, understand that, no, this is probably not the next mammoth cave, but it is worth documenting what you have here. And it has, you know, such and such scientific potential. And
so were you directly involved in sort of these landowner conversations, and were you kind of a point person for a few of these projects?
You know, I really wasn't. I was more just doing the work, doing the survey work and a little bit of cartography when I was involved there. I definitely got to know a couple of the landowners just by going with the main people in our group, but no, I was definitely not spearheading any of the conversations.
But from what you saw of the people who clearly knew what they were doing, where that was concerned, what did you take away as far as the process? Because I know people that are trying to get in good with, you know, certain landowners. And then I see also some other people that are trying to do the same thing and not having success. And I'm thinking, okay, well, is it part of their personality? Is it part of their approach? From what you've seen, what works? I mean, I know that you're not the point person, but you've been around it enough to sort of maybe understand.
You know, we were so lucky to have support from a group of cavers that lived down in that area. That, you know, if you're a neighbor, you know, if you're, hey, you know, we have a house down the valley there, or, you know, we're staying with so-and-so down the valley, or, you know, sort of, hate to say name dropping, but getting in good with a few people that are very familiar with the area, or hopefully people that actually live there, was, I think, a turning point. A lot of these relations actually, they were very well established by the time I got involved with the project. So I didn't see the very, very beginnings of it, but yeah, I think that made a huge difference, was having some good support from people that live very close to the areas where we were talking to the landowners.
So let's move further in your caving life. So I had the Yucatan down to talk about the Maya sites, the archaeological caving and the surveying down there, but it seems like that was sort of fairly early in your caving life. Am I correct in that assumption?
That's correct. Yeah.
So you were in South Central Kentucky first, and then the Yucatan came fairly afterward, soon afterward.
Right. And we were there for usually about 2 or 3 weeks each summer for about 5 years. And then the project lost funding, and we did one other small project with this archaeologist in Colombia just a couple of years ago. But other than that, now we haven't had a project there for a while.
But so tell me what you did down in the Yucatan. What was found? There were archaeological sites were you pointing the way to this, or were you kind of surveying and then you'd find something and then you'd call in people, or were they with you?
So the way it started was that the archaeologist was working with a geographer from the University of Cincinnati in order to map the surface site. So this was the site on the surface, you know, the pyramids and everything you could see, sort of see in the overgrown jungle. He was working closely with a geographer from UC. Once the cave was discovered underneath the main site where this archaeologist was working, he was talking to the geographer and said, you know, well, we can't excavate this. I don't know what we're going to do. We need someone that's an expert in caves, and we have the funding. We can, you know, bring people down here, but I don't know where to start looking for cavers. So it turned out that a man named Eric Weaver was a student of the geographer working at the University of Cincinnati at the time. And the geographer asked Eric, he said, I know you do work in caves. Does this sound like something you could put a team together to do to map this cave, you know, precisely to the point where we could tell exactly where we got all of these artifacts from, and then potentially even combining it with the mapping that was going on in on the surface. So Eric was one of the main cavers in that group I was in Kentucky, and he put together a team of, I think it was 5 of us that first year, and it's a pretty small cave. We took a couple weeks and mapped it from the entrance down to, it's a small pool of water at the very bottom, and just put one shot into each side passage and kind of got that main line surveyed, mostly so we could pull the rope and string that was in the cave strung throughout it to get people down to that water spot. Yeah. Long story short, we got through that first year of working and with the archaeologist, and Eric drew up the map and did some GIS work also with the surface data that they had and presented it to the archaeologist. And he was extremely impressed. He was he ended up bringing us back, I guess.
That's great.
Yeah, he brought us back to do the side passages the next year, and then also in the next couple years to look for other caves in the area and map those as well, and get some more information about the use of caves in the area as it pertains to his site. His archaeological site that he was working on.
So what was then found as far as the use of the cave to perhaps the Mayans?
So the first cave we were working in was pretty clearly a ritualistic location. The floor of the cave was probably, well, between 1 foot and 3 feet deep with charcoal, pot shards, and cockroaches, actually, and beetle larvae. But mostly charcoal and pot shards. Oh, there were piles and piles of broken pots and other artifacts just all throughout the cave. We found areas with lots of bones, both animal bones and human bones. We found some jewelry items and also I think it was an obsidian blade. So a blade that was obviously not from that area because I don't think there's obsidian anywhere near there, but a very, very sharp little blade piece from, you know, upwards of 1,000 to 3,000 years ago. And then in the very bottom of the cave, right before this little water spot, they tried to do cores, you know, soil cores to get some information from pollen and the charcoal. And the core that they brought was, I think, 3 feet long, and it went straight down into the ground. Like as soon as they got past a couple pieces of pots, it dropped all the way to the ground. So it was at least 3 feet deep in what almost felt like an area that they had like bonfires in the bottom of this cave. There were just huge amounts of charcoal that was the only way we could think that they could even get that much charcoal down there was that they had bonfires in the bottom of this cave. And there were a lot of bats in the cave as well. So that made the floor also covered in guano. And the air in the bottom of that cave was very bad. It was very high CO2, likely. I don't know. We could never get a CO2 monitor to actually work down there.
Uh-oh.
but it was an area where we couldn't light a match. You couldn't light a lighter. You got very short of breath very quickly. And needless to say, we did not spend much time down there. Thankfully, that was right when the first Disto X was available. And we got one of those to do that last bit of survey very quickly. So
that would freaked me out.
Yeah.
You're sounding very calm in recalling this, but that would have just, I would have just been like, I'm out of here. Let's get this shot and get out. My word.
It was interesting because a lot of the people that visited while we were there that, you know, they would want a tour of the cave or, you know, show me this water spot, show me this, you know, these piles of charcoal. And then we'd have to go, one of the cavers would have to go down to the bottom again, which was not ideal. but yeah, that was probably not great for us to be down there for very long. But there was always kind of this question of, you know, is it possible for people, say 1,000 years ago, to have destroyed the air in this cave so much that it couldn't recover?
Wow.
You know, that they lit fires and you know, left so much charcoal down there that, and then the bats moved in and there's so much guano, so much input from the surface that, you know, the air in the cave essentially could never recover.
I know this is a bit of a sort of a metaphysical question, and this is all based on feel, but like for me, being in that place where hundreds, thousands of years ago, people really sort of seemed to commune in a very special and specific way. For me, being there would sort of conjure up feelings, emotions. What did you feel when you were kind of pulling these things up and pulling these cores up and thinking, okay, so there were ritual fires here. There were perhaps sacrifices here. There's artifacts here. I don't know. How did that make you feel to be in that place?
You know, we always talked about sort of the speculation of what were these people feeling? You know, we all knew it was a very special, very unique place. But the question was always, or the conversation, I guess, while we were working there was always, why did people 1,000 years ago come here? You know, were they coming here for this bad air? You know, was it a rite of passage, or you know, you go through all these scenarios in your mind, all these possibilities of what could have drawn people there, and you know, the possibilities are endless. And I don't know if they ever actually got a full answer. There were so many pots broken there, and you know, a few ritualistic sort of either animal killings or people sacrifices, and then yeah, this place where there's a little bit of water in a place that's it's outside the cenote ring, so there's not supposed to be water in caves there. Not many caves reach the water table in that area. So
Fascinating. Fascinating
so,
stuff.
Yeah. It was a really special place, and it really makes you wonder. You know, lots of questions still swirling about that spot.
One last thing before we move on from the Yucatan is does there ever seem to be a correlation between where these sort of cities or villages seem to crop up and the location of the caves? I know the cenotes were used as freshwater wells, essentially, for some people, but these drier areas, I know you're not an archaeologist, but did you ever overhear anything like that? Well, maybe they were here because of the cave.
So I do remember one conversation with one of the archaeologists, and he speculated that there is not a major Maya site in the Yucatan that's not associated with the cave underneath. And I don't know if that's the case, but I have heard of you know, a very large cave system under Chichen Itza, and then the, you know, Teotihuacan, all of those, Tulum on the coast, all those really large Maya sites that everyone's heard about. And his theory was that almost every single Maya site is associated with a cave underneath. And interestingly enough, when Eric did all of the GIS reconstruction and with the cave map underneath, the site on the surface almost exactly mirrored the passages in the cave. And how they would have known, you know, where the cave passages are located underneath the ground and underneath their main pyramids and roads and, you know, housing complexes. It was super interesting to see the connection, and I love to hear more about if someone knows something else about you know, that connection at other locations, at other sites.
I'm getting goosebumps just from this. Like whether or not there's more, I don't know, but goodness gracious, that's so interesting. That's so cool. Oh my gosh. Okay, let's move to New Mexico, Lechuguilla. You've done a lot of stuff there.
Yeah, so let's see. Since 2011, I've done a couple week-long trips each year, and we're just close enough that we can drive down for, say, a long weekend to do day trips. A few other
I've heard of day trips in Lechuguilla, but you know, before I got into talking to Lechuguilla cavers and whatnot, I had assumed that you were only allowed in if you were doing scientific work or if you're doing survey work. And if you were doing survey work, you were there for, you know, a week at a time or whatever. And then I've heard about people taking day trips. What is the purpose of the day trips? Because you've got to have a reason to go in there, right?
Yes. You have to be approved by the park and the research. You have to have a research permit or a science permit. The research permits, which include the survey, mapping, and exploration, are approved on a yearly basis. And yeah, so the last few day trips I've been on have had survey and resurvey and also climbing goals. So yeah, of course, there's not too many horizontal leads left right or near enough to the entrance that they'll allow day trips to. But there are some. And I know, like Sean Lewis has been doing a lot of work in the Rift, as well as John Lyles, and in that area just below Boulder Falls. You know, it's with a day pack, it's maybe a half hour, 45 minutes from the entrance. And then I was involved in the climbing goals above Boulder Falls, so that's even closer, maybe 10 or 15 minutes from the entrance. Looking at you know, doing. Helping with people that are aid climbing up into the domes above Boulder Falls.
So, am I safe in assuming that any trip into Lechuguilla is there are no trips into Lech that are no big deal? NBD. Just another Lech trip. I mean, you who have done one or a couple, rather, it seems, a year for a number of years, it's got to be special every time you go back, right?
It is, for sure. It's, you know, I really like kind of both ways that I go into Lechuguilla right now. And those are these day trips that are you know, usually longer days, but you get to travel through the cave wearing a day pack, which is completely different from traveling through the cave and heading towards a camp that you're going to sleep in and live in for a week.
And it's a warm cave too.
It is. It's about, I think, 68, 69 degrees, and 100% humidity.
Yeah.
And that's what really gets most new people in there. That's why, you know, it's recommended that you try to get involved in a day trip before a week long trip or you know, a few days, because the heat and humidity is the one of the hardest parts in there. That and the sort of complicated vertical that you have to be comfortable with.
Wow! And so in Lech, with so many trips under your belt, you've probably seen a lot of places. What are some of the frontiers you've sort of helped to survey?
Let's see. In the past couple of years, I was on the trip that discovered Neuland. It was a trip that was supposed to be led by Max Wischek and from Germany, but at the last minute, I think he hurt somewhere around his foot region and couldn't go. And so Derek Bristol was put on that trip at the last minute. Max is extremely organized as a trip leader. He's amazing. And he sent us little packets of, you know, here's the current data. Here's, you know, scans of the old map, or, you know, the sketches and here's where you're heading. Here's how to get there. This is what needs to be done. So we had some resurvey goals on actually the first day of our week-long trip near Lake LaBarge. So, you know, we go all the way to camp the first day, then we come almost halfway back the next day to do these survey goals near Lake LaBarge. And our first goal was to map this small dead end crawl passage. And James Hunter was ahead on point, and he set the point, and he was heading back because he said, you know, this is the last shot. It was an unrecoverable station that they had left because they had just shot into the end, or what they thought was the end. And he starts slithering back towards myself and Derek, and he said he felt air coming out of a small hole on the side. And it turns out this small hole was only small because it had this huge gypsum rim formed around it, you know, and every indication of some really strong airflow. So James squeezed up into it and said, there's walking passage right on the other side here.
Great.
Yeah. And we said, that's what we said. We said, well, great. So we followed him up and turned to the right, and there was a huge pit. Turned to the left, and there was a huge dome. And so we surveyed what we could and left it at that, and came back the next day with rope and a few more people and surveyed down the pit and went a little ways, and there was another huge pit. These were just absolute boreholes going straight down into the earth. It was kind of surreal. It was butterflies in your stomach and kind of trying to wrap your head around it sort of day. And we were all sad because Max wasn't there. So we left a few really good leads for Max when we came back with him the next year. And yeah, that was the Neuland discovery. Let me see. Just last year, Derek Bristol led a trip that was one of the main goals was to do a climb in this very, very clean area, almost all on flowstone. This climb going out of an area called Red Lakes. It's at the very end of the Western Borehole. And Dan Austin had done a trip there the year before and gotten permission to chip open a little drapery that was blocking a passage where he could see blackness beyond. So he got into this Red Tides area, Red Lakes, and then Derek did the climb last year. And he climbed up and he got onto the first kind of big ledge, and there was a passage going off of it, still completely clean, you know, small little pools and some dripping water, which in Lechuguilla isn't the most common thing. You don't find a lot of surface water, so it's exciting when you do. And then they found a small pit, and they rappelled down and into this area that is now called Zion. It's a huge, basically flowstone mountain, and amazing draperies and stalactites and stalagmites, huge columns, lots of large pools. And we surveyed, I think, just under 3,000 feet in there last year. And it's a very dense area of formations. It's the only place that I can think of that you would travel that far in all clean gear. it's a very beautiful spot. And we were lucky enough on that trip to have with us lots of very good cave photographers. So, and two of them actually had a sets of flashes that would work on the same, the same radio system. So they could light up this room with 7 flashes, and with them all on, blasting away, and you can see all the lakes, and you can see these layer cake formations that, are 20, 30 feet high. And just thinking about it, it gives me butterflies. there was amazing pearls in this area. It's a special spot for sure.
Yeah. So, I mean, I hear that, and I just think it's amazing that there is a place that you you need, 5, 6, 7 flashes and slaves to light this whole thing up, to do it any bit of photographic justice. I mean, it's so cool that I don't know, if I were there, I would think it's so cool that I am A, here, and B, part of declaring this in a way, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. And it definitely changes the dynamic, for the group for the whole week. Everybody's just excited and happy and talking about it. And the fact that it was, broken into, on the first day, and we have this whole week to explore this area. And, it was a very special time.
So let's move on to Grand Canyon Caves. You did a great webinar with the NSS about, what was it, Double Bopper and Gryffindor Caves?
Yes. Yeah. Those are the two main ones that we've been working in for the past couple of years.
And the one, what was it, last March you did this, or was it just last 2018? I can't remember when.
So the webinar would have been right before the trips that went there in the fall. So it was,
maybe September. Summertime. Yeah. So
yeah, it was late summer, early fall. Yeah.
What I thought was interesting about the webinars, and you can find it, it's on YouTube. These NSS webinars about Grand Canyon caving, and you did the webinar essentially. What was a bummer were these prescribed burns that were happening that were totally obstructing the view of the canyon.
Oh, it's always something, isn't it?
And it made all your gear smell like smoke. And I like campfire smell, and most people do, but you're at the Grand Canyon. You want to be able to have these amazing views.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't feel that bad, because I feel like I'll be back someday, or, I went back, the next fall. But yeah, to think about if there was like a group that had gotten a permit to backpack in the backcountry in the Grand Canyon, and or they were going to do rim to rim or something like that, and this was their one chance, I would feel awful.
Well, and undoubtedly there was, because there always is. The permits fill up so fast, and there had to have been people there who were like, oh, well, this is a bummer. We picked the worst time to do this.
I mean, I can't complain, right? The caves are amazing, and the fires didn't impact our main goals. So,
but the goals were to visit Double Bopper and Gryffindor caves, and you found some. I just watched this webinar, just like, God, I am a recreational caver from Indiana who's never been outside the state of Indiana, except a few trips in Tag and a couple trips in Kentucky. And I'm just seeing all this amazing stuff that you found, not only formations, but these mummified bats and other mammals in the caves. Just incredible stuff.
Those are unique for sure. And raise some questions about those caves, and hopefully someday we'll have some answers. But yeah, those are those are some interesting findings there.
So double bopper is like a 20 plus mile system, correct?
So it's actually, it's 40 miles now.
It's 40 miles now.
Yeah.
My goodness.
Yeah.
What happened?
So there's about two trips there every fall. And this has been going for the past almost 10 years. But double bopper was first, discovered or explored in 2006, I believe. So, just over 12 years, actually, it's been known. But yeah, recently, just the past couple of years, it was a connection was found between this double bopper cave and Gryffindor cave. So now it's referred to as the double bopper cave system. And then there's, the Gryffindor entrance.
Because, correct me if I'm wrong, at the time of this webinar, what was being surveyed in Gryffindor was coming within like 80 feet of double bopper. And so a connection was later made.
Right. And some of, some of these passages we found on the line plots even overlap. and of course the data coming from the GPS of the entries can be a little bit off, and maybe there's an error somewhere in the survey, but yeah, they met up pretty tightly in a lot of spots, but only one area was where we could ever fit through.
Wow. I'm correct in saying that at the time of the webinar, though, that the length of double bopper was 23, right? Or
26, maybe, right around there.
Okay, so the connections are within the last 6 to 8 months, then.
So that webinar was that was recorded just about a month before the trips in the fall of 2018. So the connection had happened in the fall of 2017, and I think so. I think that brought the cave to about 36 miles, connecting it with Gryffindor.
Wow!
And then just this past fall, I'm actually going to give another webinar for this in March, a little update on the Grand Canyon, but it's basically what we found in the fall of 2018, and we didn't find any other connections, but we were working mostly on the Gryffindor side. Actually, the trip that I was on the Gryffindor side. And then there was another fall trip to the main double bopper entrance side. What's left in the double bopper cave system is mostly mop up. It's smaller passages. We didn't have any huge breakouts. But man, it even this past year, even this past fall of the trips there, they were no less impressive than the 10 years before them. We found an amazingly preserved fox. All of its fur still there, its ears, its teeth, and its the pads on the feet of the fox. And man, some amazing gypsum and salt formations as well.
And so, yeah, with the mummified mammals, the bats and the foxes, some of the questions that were coming in at the end of the webinar were interesting to me. I mean, it took so much for you to get there in the first place that you had to have wondered when the fox made it in there. We know how the bats got
right in
there. They can fly. Foxes cannot.
Right. And foxes and mice and rats. What else? There's a couple raccoons. Oh, ringtail cats.
Wow.
Yeah, there's a pretty large variety of mammals that are in there, and almost all of them perfectly preserved with that lower humidity in there. And
well, and the dryness just, and the salt in the air, I would imagine as well.
Right. Yeah. It's less than 40% humidity, I believe, in there. And
wow.
And the airflow is such that it's an interesting airflow situation, because you have these two entrances in adjacent canyons where there's a 1500 foot tall mesa in between them. And then, up from there, it goes up to the rim. So, most of the cave is under upwards of 3000 feet of vertical extent of rock, So there, I don't know. Sometimes when I see all the gypsum flowers and the crazy formations, I think of it like a kind of like a tube of toothpaste. There is so much weight on top of this cave. It's just pushing everything out of the walls, and you just get these walls and ceilings and floors completely covered in gypsum flowers or needles or hair. We've actually just this past fall, we found a wall that's probably, I don't know, 50 feet long and what, 20 feet high of completely covered in gypsum hair. And not like a hair here or there, but like, I don't see the wall.
It's a fuzzy room.
It's a foot of hair coming out of white, bright white hairs coming out of this wall, like completely covering the entire wall for 50 feet. And it's like 20 feet high. It's like nothing I've ever seen before. I've never seen photos of any cave looking like this before. It is very, very unique.
The photos that you shared on the webinar, I would be so nervous. I mean, you're 5 feet tall. I'm 6'2". I would be so nervous about breaking something in there with these gypsum formations coming out of the ceiling. And the one that was like a perfect corkscrew. I was amazed.
Yeah, gosh, the corkscrew is amazing. I took a picture this last fall of one that's a perfect spiral. It starts out about, it must be like 4 or 5 inches in diameter. And it spirals like without touching itself completely until it's a ball in the middle, a tiny little ball of gypsum. It's just crazy. It's absolutely crazy. and I don't know, we are just so lucky to have even seen it, to even know that it exists. And I can't put into words how special that is, you know, to have just seen it. I mean, if you get past that only, you know, 2 other people or, you know, 5 other people in the world have ever stepped here, have ever seen this before. And, you know, that doesn't even matter when you're just so happy to have seen it yourself.
Let's go to Montana.
Okay.
And tears.
Very different place.
Yeah, let's leave it at that. We can't do better than that right there. Tears of the Turtle, deepest cave in the continental U.S. And not a real fun cave either, right?
It's not. I stopped going there a couple years ago. Not going to lie. Wasn't for me. when you have, 30, 40, 50 pour off pools that are all 5 to 10 feet high, and you're only 5 feet high, you kind of look at it and just say, okay, that's not something I need to do. But I was happy to support, you know, other projects in the area and the camp trips that were going down into Tears. There is another crew getting prepared to go there at the end of this summer and try to push the cave a little bit deeper. But yeah, when I was in there, it was the years that we had just discovered a way over a sump, and that's the passage that went very, very deep. So yeah, I haven't. This last trip that we did there, I did belay as someone was climbing up a dome and near the entrance. Let me tell you, sitting on ice, a couple feet of solid ice is not where I want to belay. but we took turns. We traded off a few of us and made it happen so that the climbers could get up to, you know, see what's in this dome. So that's one of the other goals of this year, is to finish climbs like that. And there's lots of other caves in the area that we're also working in and completing the maps for and completing some climbs, some ridge walking. Definitely in the cards always on these trips. And yeah, it's, you know, in general, on the surface, it's a beautiful place to be, just hiking around in the Bob Marshall Wilderness and then camping there for a week or so.
I would just get so in my head about, you know, being in a place like Tears and making your way to the bottom. I mean, did you make it to what was known as the bottom at that time, or at least near?
So on the trips that I was on, we were surveying the frontier. I mean, I wasn't working near the entrance, during those trips.
You're staying at the terrible campsite with the plastic on the sloping mound of mud.
No, thankfully not.
No, you weren't. Okay. Good for you.
No, I was still on the day trips. We were, they weren't camping in there yet.
But how long of a day trip is that? I mean, are you talking 18, 20 hours?
You know, it takes the longest to get to the entrance from our camp.
It's a
horrid hike on the surface just to get there. And I have very short legs. So, you know, trying to follow these 6 foot plus tall guys up the mountain to get to the entrance was about what I could do. No, once we got in the cave, we weren't actually that far from the frontier, because what happened was the original survey went to a sump, and then what we had to do was back up in the fissure, and then climber went up, and then they found another horizontal passage higher in the fissure that then dropped down past the sump and went down, you know, down further along that sort of rift along the mountain there.
And it's just not a particularly pleasant cave. It's almost all vertical slots and a series of them. I wouldn't want to say nuisance drops, because the drops are fairly significant, because it is the deepest cave in the U.S., continental U.S.,
But I think the last time they counted, there was something like 56 of these small drops,
just little
one drop. Right after the other.
Gosh.
But like not close enough that you could just rig a rope at the top and rig and go all the way to the bottom. There are these pour off pools where it's, you know, it's tiny waterfalls all the way down. So at least down to the camp spot. And yeah, it gets very, very muddy, and you're in contact with the walls at all times, and it's drippy and cold and 36 degrees if you're lucky.
Yeah. That's another thing is it's a cold freaking cave.
Oh God. So cold. Yes.
So were you wearing a wetsuit? You were probably wearing a wetsuit, right?
I was not. No.
Because you're not submerged in water. You're just kind of every once in a while kind of covered in water.
Right. Well, almost always covered in water. Yeah. at the time, let's see, I had a couple layers of fleece and then a Cordura suit. And they had to switch away from Cordura and either go all to PVC or most recently, they were using these Shazam suits. They're made out of the same material as body bags. They're kind of a thick black rubbery plastic, and we thought that they were the best that we were going to get at the time, and you know, most durable. And sure enough, that cave ripped the crap out of them. and you know, thankfully, somebody had a small bottle of seam seal or seam grip, and we were repairing cave suits on the surface during off days. So yeah, it's an intense travel and very dangerous, because you know, if you slip or if anything happens, it's going to be very quick for hypothermia to set in.
Yeah. That's what like I said, I would get into my head about all of those factors. Heading in there.
Well, and I think it gets into the head of the cavers that are working down there past the camp as well. I mean, at least they have the knowledge that there is a warm place they can get back to inside the cave, and then hopefully get help to get out. But it's a dangerous situation, and you know, we're doing all we can to mitigate that for this next trip. I don't know. I've been very lucky to have not been involved in any very seriously bad situations in caves.
Well, that's a good thing, right?
Yes, very. we, you know, I've been there when people have kind of self-rescued. You know, they don't feel as well, so you know, we take some of their, you know, the people that are feeling okay take some of their weight, and they get themselves out, or you know, something like that. But yes, thankfully, no one's been seriously hurt, and everybody's been able to. Yeah, to make it through all these really tough trips. I don't know. It's a long hike into some of these places. Well, a lot of these places. I'm really thankful. It's only 2 miles to the Lechuguilla entrance from the cars. But that's normally the hardest part for me, because I have to keep up with everybody with a heavy pack. But you know, Montana is a 22-mile backpack just to get to the surface camp.
Jeez.
And then you know, a couple miles straight down into the canyon and straight back up the mountain to get to the entrances of some of these caves. And then obviously 22 miles back out to your car. And then the Grand Canyon is another monster altogether.
Well, yeah. And that one takes technical work. You're rappelling down to or past entrances and then climbing back up. I mean,
yeah. Once you're down there, but I mean, just getting to where you're camping in the canyon is, it seems like it shouldn't be that hard because it's not even 3 miles to, straight line distance to where you're going to camp. But man, it's about 2 miles on the rim and then less than a mile down to your camp. And in that 3/4 of a mile, you lose about 3,000 feet of elevation on zero to very, very little trail. And sometimes rappelling, lowering your pack down and down climbing. It's very vertical on the surface with no trail. I mean, it's hiking down into the Grand Canyon, with no trail and with a very heavy pack again. So, just staying in good enough shape just to get to these places is sometimes my biggest challenge. But yeah, it's worth it for sure.
Let's come full circle. So you grew up in Cincinnati, any Indiana caving?
Gosh, I don't think I ever did.
Did you? You never made it next door?
No, we always went straight south whenever we could.
All you Ohio cavers, you just go down to Kentucky and never come west.
I went with a friend to Versailles one time and went to the park there. I think there was a few caves there.
There's a couple little caves there, but nothing compared to what's in the Crawford Upland. What's wrong with you?
Uh-oh. In trouble.
You might be. No, we've got some great caves in Indiana. Nothing like what's down in Kentucky, but I mean, we got some really cool stuff. I would invite you to come check them out. You seem like more of a project caver, and we got a couple of projects going on in Indiana, but there's some great recreational sites in Indiana too. I'd love to hear about an Indiana trip that you take sometime.
All right. Well, yeah, I still have friends and family in Cincinnati, so I make it there pretty often. And of course, still have my large box of WNS gear that I left there. So, yeah. So I'm good to go.
Yeah. If you come back home and you got some time, let us know. We'll the CIG or the BIG or any of the Indiana grottos will hook you up.
All right. Sounds good.
Well, Beth Courtwright, thank you so much for taking some time with us tonight.
All right. Well, thank you.
The offer stands, Beth. We'd love to take you caving in Indiana. Thanks again. Great caver. Great communicator, too. No wonder they have her host those webinars. Thanks for listening. Remember to take some time and check out SCCI, become a member, or kick a few extra bucks their way to help them out with the new Charles B. Henson Preserve at Johnson's Crook and all their other preserves. Thanks to our sponsors, past and present, SwagoGear.com and Organic Robot on Etsy. Next month, I'm excited to bring you an in-studio guest. This is a guy who's been part of my grotto, the Central Indiana Grotto, for many years. He's done stuff down in Mexico, lots of projects here in Indiana, of course, and just an interesting guy and a great storyteller, too. I had a great time talking to Rusty Riley. He will be my guest on May 1st. And I have a lot of interviews already in the can coming later this year that I can't wait to share. And I'll be doing more soon that I'm very excited about. It's shaping up to be a really great year for the podcast. So I appreciate you coming back every month. If you or someone you know should be a guest on the podcast, put me in touch with them by emailing me at alpineproductions@gmail.com. alpineproductions@gmail.com. I'm Matt Pelser of the Central Indiana Grotto. Until next time, kill nothing but time.